Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
I wasn't talking about what I wanted or needed. I was saying our listeners.
Wait, we have those?
Next topic, right?
Yeah, okay.
I don't. This isn't on our topics list. It's, yeah.
This is why it's good to stick to the topics list, because then we're less likely to get into trouble.
I scroll down and there's actually a thread on it.
Just let me amend the topics list and send it out first, Phil.
A composite show, archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time. From episode 112.
Are the one-tile island cities worth the effort? In my recent game, I have found myself on the end of, pardon me, of the map relegated to island hopping, which is not my favorite scenario. I'm not a fan of Navy games. I have seen many one-tile islands nearby that contain resources that I wouldn't mind having. Marble, spices, etc., etc. I am just wondering if they are worth plonking a city down in the middle of a freaking ocean. With no supporting land tiles, I can't have any supporting land artillery units to help defend in case war breaks out. So I think I would have to park a warship in or around the city at all times. Plus, thinking it would take forever to get anything built without hammer resources. Now, oil, coal, uranium would probably be no-brainers, but luxury resources? I'm putting this game on the back burner until I can figure out if it's worth continuing. I don't really want to get into a series of one-tile island cities and having to support a huge navy to defend them.
To me, your one-tile island cities, if you are want for a particular resource, and I'm going to emphasize kind of what the opening poster said here, not necessarily luxury resources in and of itself. If you're without a particular luxury resource, you probably have an excess of something else that you could trade to somebody else for that. But if we're talking about a strategic resource here, depending upon the point in the game, then it may be worth the fact that, hey, that city's not going to be able to do much of anything because I can either get that resource because I planted, or it's going to be within a few tiles of the city, and maybe it's not going to be able to grow that much. It really is a very situational sort of a thing from the perspective of the one-tile islands for yourself. And then as for the one-tile islands that the AI would like to do, well, as Raw points out in the thread, now with the way the game is set up in terms of winning a domination victory, you just have to go and take the capitals. You wouldn't have to worry about, oh, I got to get rid of this person to eliminate them from the map. But really, even if you did, what kind of threat would they be? Often those one-tile city things, I just end up leaving them alone if they're an AI situation. At least, depending upon the stage of the game. If it's a little later on, then go back and get it later, but,
And if you've conquered the main part of the AI already, those little one-tile island cities aren't going to produce much anyway, because if you look at what Urden was saying in the second post, it's going to take you 50 to 100 turns through the harbor unless you buy it in, and there's just no production.
Well, the key is having enough gold to buy, your buildings so that you get a lighthouse, so you have food, and just keep using that city for purchasing your buildings, seeing what you can do, expecting little from it, and doing it mostly in later game.
Yeah, for me, unless it had a strategic resource or had a really strategic location that I needed to hold, then, I wouldn't bother.
I think whether you want to build those cities is circumstantial, but the poster seems to be worried about their defense. I wouldn't worry too much about that, because if you lose that city, it doesn't produce much military anyway, so it doesn't hurt much if you lose it, I guess. So.
Yeah, and it's going to take fairly strong units to crack it anyway, because they're going to have to take a hit for amphibious just to attack.
Also, if your opponent is smart, he'll attack your main production cities first. So.
Yeah. They're worried about your one-tile island cities, not smart.
Well, the thread's sort of talking about settling, isn't it?
Yeah, but all those things are going to apply if you're going to start upwards, especially if you're on an archipelago map or something. You're going to have to do the tile islands anyway.
Sure, but I guess it's easier to settle it than it is to capture it. But
yes, it is far easier. That is optics and a cellular plonk. Taking it, I hope you have a strong unit, because once that city starts getting some defense in it and you take the amphibious hit, ouch. It's not as impossible as it was like in Civ 4, where you almost really had to wait for Marines or to get a unit where you could give them the amphibious promotion. But it's still pretty, you'd have to wait for long swords or something at least, I'd think.
Where I find myself doing it, you know, I'm in agreement with you, Dan, about, well, you trade for it, but it seems the way diplomacy is at the moment, just when you start to win, well, somebody doesn't like you, then you have the denouncement cascade, and all of a sudden you don't have any trade anymore.
Well, now the patch is going to fix that denunciation cascade, right?
Yeah.
Well, even assume for a moment that it doesn't, or we wanted to play the game.
It should help.
That's kind of what I was getting at in terms of what type of resource is it that you're going to be going for. If it's something that you need and you absolutely do not have it at all, and it depends on the era, but I'm going to go with iron specifically. And of course, there are other ways that you could also acquire iron, of course, other than not only, and I don't just mean, of course, trade with quote unquote proper AIs that are also looking to win the game, but you could also be getting that from city states. So really, to me, especially with the city state factor in there, the desirability of a one tile island is gone down, but then at the same time, you may not have that many city-states around you. They may not be particularly friendly towards you. They may already be allied with somebody else. But I think there definitely are times when it's a benefit to have these, to have the one-tile islands. And you know, Mac, you mentioned about having to have a really strong unit in order to take it out. If you're looking at taking that city yourself, I would have multiple of particular units, and I would have, if I want to be able to take it out as quickly as possible, then sure, come in with Navy units that have a bombard capability to help out, move them back, and then move in your units, even if they don't have the amphibious assault, attack with as many units as you can on that particular turn. And if you're leaving those cities, until after you've taken out whatever their mainland presence is, then their ability to have additional units, whether it's actually a land unit in the city or some other naval units to try to take things out of your own invasion, and also their own ability to stay up with you in terms of technology, I think you're setting yourself in a really good position, be it single player or multiplayer.
From episode 120.
Has anyone ever, and that's on purpose because this is in all caps, has anyone ever made a defensive pack in Civilization V? A little bit of background, a defensive pack is available with the Chivalry technology. Packs are mutual, so if a signatory to one is attacked, then the other partner is automatically at war with the other attacker. At the very least, you declare war anyway. Whether you're actively engaging is an entirely separate matter. Defensive packs last 20 turns and afterwards must be renegotiated. But if one of the participants declares war on anybody, then it is nullified. And in this thread, Lord Zuri08, I love it when the usernames just roll off the tongue, says it's a cool aspect of Diplo and it adds much-needed depth to the game with only one drawback. The AI never makes them, quote unquote. And let me just also say that it's not only the AI that never makes them. I do not find myself making defensive packs in Civilization V at all.
So why is that?
I think it's probably best pointed out in one of the posts by Philly Noctis, where you can be forced into a war that you have a pact with because they've attacked another civ that you have a pact with. Not that that is in and of itself a problem, but the thing is you get a Diplo hit because now you have declared on a friend in this situation as if you were the aggressor. Now, Philly also says you're having to keep track of every war to make sure none of your pacts have expired because the other party declaring war and having to re-sign every pact if you declare war on or if you have an ally that is declared on. I agree that there are a lot of these agreements that you make in Civ 5 that automatically expire after 20 turns and or whatever the number of turns happens to be. I'm not sure if it scales with speed or not. I don't think so, game speed. But you're obviously, but you're constantly having to renew it. Oh, right, the turn where I was giving ivory for wine has expired, or gold per turn has expired. So I guess we need to renew that now. I don't think that's so much of a functional concern, because you do get that in-game notification that reminds you, always looking on the right-hand side at the start of a turn, yes, this needs to be renewed. It adds time to the turn, which I suppose if you're on a turn timer in multiplayer, it can be an issue, but the turn timer is so slow, I don't really think that's a particular issue. But it's that first one where you get that Diplo hit that, you know, I've declared a defensive pact, so someone has declared, and now I'm doing the friendly thing. Like, this is a defensive pact, but now I'm the warmonger?
Right. You know, for me, one problem I run into a lot with any sort of diplomatic system is if something like this worked reliably, where if I could be certain that my pact partner would actually intervene effectively on my behalf, I would pursue the diplomatic options much more aggressively. Because it takes time and attention to nurture those relationships and finally get someone to commit to, you know, a pact with you. But when I do take the trouble to finally get someone I think is going to be a useful ally who can, you know, protect me from whoever the bully is, way too often, now we're at war, and I am still fighting entirely by myself. And in fact, my mistake was ever calculating that I would receive real help in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, it's not just those side effects you mentioned, but it's also, I find defensive packs kind of a question mark. Like, you know, how is it really going to impact the game if it comes into action?
Well, the biggest problem for me with defensive packs in any of the civilizations that have defensive packs, that is 4 and 5, is that we are throwing away our war decisions to an AI, basically. We are automating our war declarations. And we may be thrown to a war that we don't want. We don't automate workers. We don't automate any of those aspects. So if we want to play minimally right. But if we do a defensive pact, we are saying to an AI, now stay there. You decide when I go to war and against who I go to war. I don't even do it that with humans. Even more with an AI.
Well, and there's also the question of being ready for war if the pact comes into action, where, you know, am I going to have to, because like you said, you're kicking this really important decision over to the vagaries of the AI. And so how prepared do you have to be? Like, suddenly if you are sucked into a war that you really were hoping to avoid, you know, do you really want to be carrying around a big standing army ready to fight a war just whenever the AI happens to trigger one? That's not really a position you want to be in. That's, you know, creating a useful military in Civ is a significant investment, and it's not one I want. You know, if I'm going to carry that investment, I want it to be purpose driven. You know, a war on my terms, a war of my choosing, or at least a clearly defined enemy that I need to protect myself from.
That's right, and if you're giving that control over to the AI, you're thinking, okay, the defensive pact, okay, why am I getting the defensive pact of this person? What civ do they border on? What civ might attack them? Like, who are they looking for protection from? And then how can I protect myself? So, as Rob said, I need a standing army in order to protect myself, and aggravated in Civ 5 by the one unit per turn, as well as some general production issues anyway in terms of getting those units out, those units have to kind of be on standby for a war that may or may not happen. Then, as I think you also pointed out, Rob, they drag you into the war, and then often in a few turns, they get peace, but that's it. And then it's like, wait a minute. Okay, so I really wasn't the person that the other AI was going after, so surely to gosh, they'll declare peace with me. No, they'll take peace with me. So it's like, no, we're not interested in talking to you. And even if you're on the other side, it's like, yes, I had a defensive pact, and now this big bully has declared on me, and that other person, maybe that person is even, you know, right in between us, for instance. What active participation are they actually giving in the war? You know, are they just saying, like, when you contact them, oh, you know, we'll be able to take out this civ really soon? Is that the royal we? Because I don't see much of doing anything. It's kind of like pledging to protect the city-state from the AI. Well, that's great, but if I attack that city-state, well, what does the AI typically do about it? Not much of anything. They give you lots of words of encouragement, but no real active participation in the war.
There are times, and I'm certain this is just, you know, gamer paranoia, right? Where you convince yourself that the game has it in for you. But there have been so many times when a defensive pact has so perfectly screwed me over that I feel like there was some sort of malignant AI design behind the entire thing all along, where my partner, you know, manages to, you know, upset the great power in the game. You know, a war starts, I get pulled into it, and then they bail immediately. And I've been hung out, like, you know, a game that was going pretty well earlier is now bogged down in this hugely ugly war of attrition that there was no way I was going to be able to successfully prosecute this war by myself. And the AI set me up for doing exactly that, where, okay, great, I guess the next 200 turns are going to be about fighting over this border.
Good old Ghost in the Machine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Basically, in all Civ games I have played, from Civ 3 to Civ 5, I've seen that happening all the times. An AI comes to beg for help. Help me, help me, help me. And then, suddenly, I decide to help, and bye-bye. Keep the good fight for me.
Yeah, it's kind of even a worse experience than in, like, Civilization 4, when an AI would say, hey, why don't you switch to my favorite Civic? Why don't you do that? That'll make us more friendly. Okay, and then the next turn, wait a minute, they just went into another Civic, and I just switched into it. It's kind of like, wait a minute, is this just a whole ruse? I mean, I can see situations where it actually is beneficial for a defensive pact, and that kind of came up in the thread. Particularly if you're not going for a domination victory, if you think that you can suck up to a nearby AI and they're going to be able to buffer you, or at the very least, oh, well, if that, you know, this civ, I've got the defensive pact with them, with Civilization X, Civilization Y could attack them, but what's the practicality of Civilization Y actually coming in and turn doing something to me, assuming that only maybe if they're then able to take out Civilization X, and that could take some time, and then that maybe gives me time to have a little bit more of a defensive army if you're going for a cultural victory or a space race victory or something like that. But that's typically not me as a Civilization player. I'm typically looking for the domination victory. So really need to be careful about who I go to war with, when I go to war with, and under one circumstances. Because, you know, it's one thing for an AI in Civ 5 to say, hey, you know, so-and-so's being a real pest. Like, why don't you join us? You talked about the prep there, Rob. Well, there is that option. We talked about this on a recent episode where you can say, give us 10 turns to get ready. And then in that situation, you actually get another notification. So it's been 10 turns. Are you actually going to declare? You actually get another choice. Whereas in a defensive pact, it's just, boom, ready or not, you're in it, and you need to be ready or not. And if you've got that, you know, if that standing army around and you're supporting that for what may or may not come, and you think, gee, particularly if you're going for domination, I like to take out this other civ that's on the other side of me, but I can't afford to move that much of my army into that other war. So either they're getting ahead in tech and I'm not able to use my military advantage, and then maybe they too become a threat. So it really is a very situational thing, and there's definitely some flaws in the mechanics. I like informal defensive packs, quote-unquote, which is simply, oh, man, Civilization X declared on Civilization Y. You know, if they take out Civilization Y, now I've got borders with Civilization Civilization X, and that in itself has a diplomacy hit, so it actually might be to my benefit to actually go to the aid of the civilization that's been declared on. That's in my control. Mine!
We are all control freaks.
What? We play a game where we're building an empire to stand the test of time, and we're controlling all of these decisions? Do we like control? Gee, I don't know if I go that far. Oh, excuse me. And we'd like to welcome LZPRST and Mickey. Yes, I had to raise my voice an octave for dramatic effect. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
I have acquired sufficient caffeine.
Just to tie it into the topic here, I don't think it's possible to consume enough caffeine and think that defensive packs are generally a good idea, though.
What's that have to do with caffeine?
Maybe if you had enough alcohol, maybe then you
would. Oh, yeah. Defensive packs might be a great idea. Yeah, there you go.
I don't use them.
For episode 122.
Thread started by Jim Bro. Can you please explain to me what's the point of hydro plants? I'll read his post first and then give a little intro on what the plant is. It says, you have a city with a 35 production, which is okay, and it takes 35 turns, that was an all caps, fine neutralization, to build the hydro plant. The hydro plant costs 3 gold to maintain, takes 2.5 times or so production time to complete compared to the windmill, costs 1.5 times more to maintain than the windmill, and yet gives less than the windmill. At best, the hydro plant only gives plus 5 hammers, or maybe 6. Sorry, but can someone explain to me what's the advantage in building hydro plants? Hydro plants require plastics in the modern era. 402 hammers to build, 3 maintenance. And for that, you get plus 1 production in every tile next to a river. Requires 1 aluminum resource, and obviously a city must be built next to the river. I think, first and foremost, it really is going to be situational in the sense that this topic does not apply if you don't have any city next to the river, which I suppose is possible, probably not purposeful. Maybe the map just does that for you. But we talked before about the production nerf that is Civilization V. I'm going to try to strictly speak to the pre-patch right now because that does have some impact. Take into account what that's going to happen, but the point of a hydro plant would, for those cities to me that are already of a decent production, either that, because again they are 402 hammers, or they could actually be used even for cities that don't have very good production but are on the river. You rush by it, assuming you pay for it, and now you get plus 1 production in every tile next to a river, so it may not be a production powerhouse, but at the very least, it could be another city that is giving you some production. Yes, there is the 3 maintenance, and it does require 1 aluminum, and aluminum can tend to be pretty dicey in terms of availability. So you've got to think about the trade-off for having that aluminum being used for that as compared to, say, a unit, purpose of a unit, and then also deciding, is it going to be worth the time, the money, and really I think it's the 1 aluminum that takes it that really making me decide, okay, yeah, the city's on a river, do I want to make that investment? Is it going to pay for me in the long run? I mean, you know, by the time you get it in plastics for in the modern era, like how close are you to finishing the game, whatever your victory condition is? I think if you're like going for a spaceship victory, I think it's even more desirable just because of how expensive those are, and you can't rush by those. But there is a point to hydro plants.
Yeah, I guess the considerations on using things like this are not really my strong suit because you're talking about making calculations here and that kind of micromanagement. That doesn't really suit somebody who's placed very quickly. But if any time you wanted to do it, you can certainly take a look at what you're paying to create the improvement, the city improvement, hydro plant, and how long you're going to have until you expect to finish the game, or you know how quickly your other options will give you something that's equally or more worthwhile. And you can usually come up with whether or not it's going to be worth your time to build the building or not. Certainly, it could scale maybe a little better compared to the things that come before it, but in cities where that production bonus is worthwhile, it can be really worthwhile. I guess if you're that late in the game, it's worth considering for more production. That is the point.
And I think just to touch very ever so briefly on the patch, given what's happening with the patch, I think hydro plants are going to be, generally speaking, slightly more of use to you, but we'll perhaps get into that more when we start talking about the patch. But, I mean, the hydro plants, I mean, really, it's not to the same consideration in the sense of Civilization IV, and I'm only speaking of that in terms of that you would often, if you could try to get a hydro plant as compared to, say, a nuclear plant, because there was always that meltdown risk, and you don't have that in Civilization V. And if I remember correctly, speaking of other power plants, a nuclear plant requires 1 uranium instead of 1 aluminum. So, you know, the hydro plant could be, again, depending on where your city's settled, it, you know, it could be of good use to you for some additional production. I do think the strongest argument for it is if you want to be building those spaceship parts and then combine that with, what is that, the research lab that gives you an additional boost to
spaceship part production?
And not to pull on the elephant's tail too much here, but I actually don't see any announcements to change the hydroplant in the patch notes, but I could just be missing it.
I was just talking in terms of production issues in general, actually.
Okay, yes. Yeah, we'll get to that, yes.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, Bigor makes a good point here that there's a good user that posted this complaint about hydroplants wasn't really making a lot of production in the first place. I mean, to have it even worth it, you need to have a certain amount. I don't know. I mean, how many would you say at which, like, building a hydro plant would be efficient? I mean, okay, I have to do some calculations in my head right now, but...
Just depends. It depends how far you are from finishing the game and what else you want to accomplish with the city. Certainly, the more base production you have, the more useful a production multiplier is going to be. And that's just how Civ works in general with all of its multipliers, but...
Yeah, but it's like, you know, if you're going for culture, why bother?
Oh, yeah.
I guess to build culture buildings, but, I mean, in Civ 5, it's not really expeditious to really use that method.
I don't know. Maybe in the city you want to build the Louvre in. I don't know.
I was going to say, if this late in the game you're still working on culture buildings, you're in trouble.
Well, at some point you turn over your focus to culture almost entirely once you have key techs, so... I don't know why you would pursue this particularly, and then by the time this would be available, you probably wouldn't have that many culture buildings left. That would matter a lot.
From episode 124.
Should I develop jungles, a Civilization V topic, started by Racer X? He says, quote, I typically leave them alone since I get +2 science boost from them, as I recall. However, I wanted to see what others do with them to see if I can do something better with them, quote, unquote. I will say that when I see jungles in Civilization V, I am clouded by the Civilization IV experience, and I have not left them alone, as would have been advantageous to me for the science output. Particularly, shall I dare say, post-patch now. So we're going to talk about the patch until later, but it's going to creep into the other topic discussions anyway. And I know Magin, anyway, actually had a reply in this thread. I don't know what he was doing. He was supposed to save the reply for the show.
What? Oh, I did that before you even asked me. It's not my fault.
That's irrelevant.
Is this why you asked me on? That's it? You saw one post and said, oh, we've got to talk about that.
Hey, let's not get into the methodology behind things here.
Jungles, I mean, it really comes down to how many are there. You know, if you've got one jungle and it doesn't have bananas in it, then it's not really going to help you much unless you're doing a gold-based city there anyways, in which case, obviously, throw a trading post in it and you've got 2 food, 2 gold eventually. And, of course, with the university, you get the 2 science or the 2 beakers. The thing with jungles, though, is that if you get rid of them, you're basically... probably about 90 to 95% of the chance going to get a plains underneath. I know there's certain maps, like the Earth map, that in South America there's actually grassland underneath, and it doesn't actually tell you what's there, but for the most part, it's either if you're in heavy jungle, well, okay, the plains will get you some production that you're going to be sorely needing. But if it's, you know, 4, 5, 6 jungle tiles close to a nice settling area, why not trading post them, get the science out of it, especially post-patch, where, you know, getting boosted science is a good thing from the tiles. It's your only real chance to get it from tiles, so... it's somewhat well worth it. And personally, no, I do not put a plantation on a jungle. I'd much rather get the 3 food and 2 science versus 4 food. And even still, you don't really get good food out of it until you get to fertilizer now for the plantation boost, where you can get, at that point, 5 or 6 food, depending on where it is. Not bad.
I think we should note that by putting a trading post on a jungle, you are not eliminating the jungle.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, that also mixes with, if you go rationalism, then you get the two science from the jungle and another one from the trading post. So you end up with a 3 beaker tile.
And And yes, you mentioned that yes, you do need the university, which of course requires a library or a Chinese paper maker. And I'm going to mention the patch. I apologize already.
Stop it.
But you're saying stop it. That just means I'm going to mention it more. So if I've followed my documentation correctly, a university is actually a little cheaper now as compared to pre-patch. It was 200 and it's now 160. And it's also less maintenance. It's 2 now and it was 3.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about that.
Oh, whoa. Sounds like it's for Rage or something.
Starts with I and ends in S. To be in the middle.
No, actually, that's not the way I'm at. Now, the university cheaper. That's not bad given the changes to the overall science output. So it might be a little cheaper to get the university out, but it's also lost 17% of the bonus it had.
Yes, from plus 50% science in the city to plus 33%.
Yeah, and that plus 17% that's missing is now in rationalism as a social policy choice. So that I really do like. If you want high science, you need to go rationalism. If you want happiness and culture, you go piety. That was actually a good balance change because before the patch, you know, flying through all a large chunk of different social policies all over the tree to get a variety of things, and basically you could get science and ignore rationalism and superpower through your the whole thing even without focusing on it. You know, it didn't quite make sense. Now you have a little bit more focus when it comes to some of these things.
And of course, early to our listening audience, and I'm sure at least Anna Lee will agree with me, I'm sure, that when Majin says stop it in terms of talking about the patch before we actually get to the topic, what he actually meant was stop it, I wanted to do that.
No.
I wondered about that.
I think also worth mentioning with regards to the university is in terms of the tech path towards that university, because I think we know how important money is in this game. If you have those jungles, then you might be thinking, well, that's great, but I'm not going to have the production to build the university. Well, you can just rush by it, and then that city can be a science powerhouse, particularly early on in the game.
For episode 127.
In order to get these wonders, you have to pay for the downloadable content. The wonders are just not tied to the specific scenario. You can build these in the base game, but assuming you have the DLC. But Skyder says that now the downloadable content is, quote, you're starting to piecemeal out parts of the core game. I fear this new DLC, when you're charging us for money for standard in-game wonders, will be a harbinger of worse things to come. What's next? Will we have to pay money for additional resources, technology, and units? This will truly be a travesty, unquote. I think if we look just back at Civilization IV, we did not have downloadable content, but we had expansion packs. And let's look at the second and last expansion pack for Civ IV, Beyond the Sword. Can't remember what specifically, but I'm sure, and I meant to look this up to be more specific, but I'm sure it introduced wonders. New wonders. I don't know how you can talk about a wonder of the world being part of the core game when you don't have it already, and it's not necessarily you're going to have this anyway in the course of a game. Like if suddenly, you know, 2K and Firaxis said, okay, would you like mounted units in the game? That's downloadable content. Okay, then I might start to see, okay, that's like a core game issue. I don't feel that we're being slighted by having these wonders as part of downloadable content, although, you know, I can see where he's coming from. I don't feel that negatively about it.
Well, there's still some things I would rather see first, such as significant improvement to hotkeys and controls in the game. Just, you know, lots of little minor things, like queuing up units in cities that's been problematic for about a year. Yeah, things like that I would rather see before the wonders, but I agree with you, Dan. This isn't something where, like, people who have DLC get an advantage and people don't have it, have a disadvantage then. And it's not like these wonders were necessarily required to play Civ 5 vanilla effectively.
Right.
Probably not, but who knows. My guess is no, based on past. But yeah, if they worked in multiplayer, but only available for some people, then I'd have a major issue with it. That's overstepping, if it starts ruining competition like that, it's not good. I don't hear any evidence of that happening. I think DLC in general doesn't work too well in the multiplayer, right? So.
You see, that was actually another discussion within there, is that some people were saying, hey, if I bought the downloadable content, I should be able to use it in multiplayer, the end. But I disagree with that, because what happens right now is, in Civilization V, if you want that downloadable content included, then every person who is joining your game has to have that downloadable content installed. Even if nobody uses it, even if everybody goes random and you don't roll it, and AI doesn't roll it if you don't have it, if there's one person that doesn't have it, they cannot join your game. You get you'd have incompatible downloadable content. The thing is, you can have it. You can have it as part of your account. I can go and get Korea, but when I set up the game, you check off what downloadable content you want to be enabled for that game. So if I know I'm the only one with Korea, and all five people I'm playing with don't, then I just don't check that box. And now you don't have to worry about someone choosing to use that in a multiplayer game because they have access to it and nobody else does. Now, if somebody wanted to go in and mod that so that could happen, I don't even know if that's even technically possible. But if it is, that's the way to go about it, as opposed to case in Civ 4.
There was no issue there. You had the same patch version and the same expansion, and you played it, or you didn't, and you couldn't.
There you go. So it's good the way it is, actually.
Well, version compatibility has become an issue. There's no denying that.
With Civ 4 or Civ 5?
With Civ 5, just because you can't use your DLC, because nobody else is going to have bought the exact same DLC, or much fewer people. So you're going to wind up not being able to use DLC in multiplayer frequently. And that is a concern we expressed way back before any of this even started, but it's what it is. It's the way companies are going now, and if everyone has it, you can use it, so it's not the worst thing.
Again, with an industry perspective here, even in this day and age, the vast majority of games that are sold, people just play offline. Like, for instance, Unreal Tournament 2004, I think it was hugely successful in multiplayer, but still, like, 98% of the people who bought it only played offline. So that's probably the same situation
as
Civ 5. Yeah, I'm serious.
Oh, my God.
So they had to cater to the offline crowd, even though the hardcore people...
I didn't realize it was that ludicrous.
It's pretty silly, yeah.
Because that game is, like, built for multiplayer.
I know.
It has such a huge single-player component to the game, and people compete on the single-player component aspect of the game. Like, Unreal Tournament's made for multiplayer. Wow, just to have 2% of people playing online, that's interesting.
I guess there's a lot more people out there than we know that just, you know, browse through the store and they say, this looks cool, they pick it up, they play it a few times, they put it down, but that's where the majority of the income and the revenue comes from publishing a game.
I see. Well, yeah, then from an industry standpoint, you'd have to go through the mass of your purchasers. There's no way.
But again,
go to rallies and things along those lines. If
exactly.
You know, if we're on a podcast here, then we're definitely not the normal user in any way, shape, or form.
No, we're superior. I mean, no, yeah, continue.
clearly. To be included, all listeners, you guys are also superior. Just, you know, to clear things up. It's only if you're not listening that makes you inferior.
That's true, yes. You're all podcasters in a way. Even if you are not actually on a podcast, if you listen to podcasts, you are a podcaster.
True. I would say anybody that's listening in to a podcast of Civ 5 is in the minority, but the flag-bearing minority that kind of dictates the direction the game is taking. But you got to realize we're not the masses.
No, we're the landed elite. And
true story. 15% growth. The internet elite, for that matter, yes.
You mentioned, Phil, about how we were discussing last year with regards to, you know, downloadable content and not being able to use it in multiplayer. And if I was part of that, maybe I should – can't remember the specifics of exactly what I said. That does make me sound old a little bit. But I like how it is right now that if you want to play with the downloadable content, then you want to find somebody or somebody else that also has that same downloadable content. Some people suggest, hey, if one person buys the downloadable content, then somebody who's joining that game should have the use of that downloadable content for that multiplayer game in and of itself. But I think I guess I can kind of see that in a way, because then you say, well, then they don't have the single player experience and it just goes away. But I think that the downloadable content, if you have that, if one person has it and somebody else doesn't, then it can become a focal point in terms of either only one person can play that particular Civ in a particular game, but I think it's actually everybody could choose to be the same civilization, kind of like in Civilization IV. You know, what color of ink are you? I like that distinction. And just have it so that, you know, if you don't have the downloadable content, then nobody can play with it. I can see the minor point where someone says that, Mongolia shouldn't be included on that list because it's free. Well, you do have to add it. You know, it's not like a patch where it's automatically pushed to you. You have to go and say, yes, add this. So I wouldn't call it like a version mismatch if some people are playing with downloadable content and others not. I'd get really frustrated if suddenly we had to pay for like these patches, for instance, that are addressing stuff in-game as of the base game, as it were. But as far as downloadable content goes, I don't see we need any change when it comes to the multiplayer component.
Yeah, it's not ideal just because you have fewer total people in the pool that have the same versions of the game and are going to play the same version of the game. But I think when you go with the DLC model, they're doing it the best way that you can do it under the DLC model. So I don't really have any complaints in that regard.
I agree. It's impossible to make everybody happy, but they, I'm sure, have sat down just like we're sitting here, discussed it, figured out what's going to work. They probably even run numbers behind it, and they're doing what they can with it, and I think they've got the best setup.
I think it's cost-benefit from their side. I mean, you know, the people they're playing single-player content are the people who are paying like this. And as a result of that, I just think they're probably on their best effort to deal with the different challenges to make the DLC broadly available in multiplayer.
You know, Sparkle makes an interesting point in the chat that from a company point of view, letting others use your downloadable content in multiplayer, that they might then buy it for their single-player games in turn. That'd be good from a business point of view, and you could argue that if it's good from a business point of view, then the company's still going to be paying attention to the game, making more downloadable content, and as some people have actually noted in here, it's good that there's downloadable content and it's coming out in segments because then the company is getting a continuous revenue stream, not just from those people picking up Civ 5 after the fact, buying as a gift for someone, waiting for it to become heavily discounted, as Steam likes to do with their weekend deals. I can see that from like a business point of view, you know, but letting the user downloadable content in multiplayer that they might, you know, get it for their single player games. I guess I'm not in and of itself objecting to that. I could come over to that point of view.
Well, I like it. I think that's a great idea that you could just let people use it sort of for free online, but then since the majority of the games are played offline anyway, you'd have to pay for it offline. There would still be incentive for people to buy it, and most people would not be online to get the free copy in the first place, so you wouldn't be losing out on much revenue. So I think that's a good idea. Whether they'll go that way or not is for us to say.
It's an interesting point, because as I pointed out earlier, we're, you know, the typical online multiplayer gamer is apparently not the largest part of your audience. So it's not like people would be getting access to the Civ in multiplayer to the extent that it just wouldn't be sold for single-player content purposes.
Hey, and on that note, it would be good because it could get people playing online that would normally not be playing online because there's free stuff, right? So everybody likes free stuff, and it would build up a community, possibly?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, it might draw extra people to the game. I'm not sure if that would make more money or less money for them, but it's certainly something to look at. It sounds like a good idea, especially because it would make games more compatible.
And that's the really nice part, is that you wouldn't have to care about version mismatch because everybody's got it all.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, increase the likelihood that everybody would have it all because, hey, essentially, in that situation like Sparkle is describing, then just like there's a demo for Civilization V, there's the way that you can get the, air quote, demo of the new downloadable content.
For episode 129.
Seth Phyllis posted about role-playing Civs in the Polystries. In his post, he says, I thought I would share one thing I do to make the game more enjoyable for myself and a bit more difficult. Rather than choose policy trees based on game situation or some set build, I limit myself to policy trees that I feel are appropriate for each civilization based on my fairly broad but not infinite historical knowledge. He always plays as random. He made a little sheet and tried to distribute the policies evenly among the civs. And he's got his chart here, and every civ gets 5 policy trees. 2 out of tradition, liberty. 1 of either piety or rationalism. 1 of either patronage or commerce. And then 1 out of freedom, autocracy, or order. So he set it up to try and have as many different combinations possible to keep kings different. And he wanted to know if anyone else role-played their policy choices. I don't think I've tried that before, but that's an idea. Although I do feel like if I'm playing American, I take something like order, I feel kind of silly.
Yeah, we should take police state.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, feeling silly is half the fun for me sometimes, but, you know, everybody plays differently.
I like the idea of it. I mean, I'm not necessarily myself interested in it, but I think it's an interesting approach where you're thinking more about aligning yourself historically to the civ that you choose on your own or you randomly choose. My favorite part of the thread was people disagreeing about which policy or policies best align.
Yeah.
You're like, why is you say piety instead of rationalism? I'm sorry, have you seen how much the church gets involved even though it's supposed to be separation of church and state? Just saying.
Yeah, I mean, it makes for a good forum discussion.
Entirely.
But any of the historical civs, you can really match up just about any policy tree to any civ. I mean, if you're going to go look at France over the, you know, whatever, 1,000 years of their history, or if you're going back to pre-modern times, 2,000 years, I mean, you could really apply pretty much any of those trees to any of them. I mean, has France been pious at points in time? Yes. Have they been rational at points in time? Yes. Have they been an autocracy at certain points in time? Yes. Do they have a lot of tradition? Yes. I mean, you can apply that to just about any of them. The whole idea of role-playing, though, is great. Fun is where you find it. I think that if you can do things like that, it goes a long way to extending the lifespan of a game that you love to play. If you can do things like that, I've always been a big fan of doing variants, playing games in unexpected, unusual ways. So the fact that people are doing that with Civ 5, I think that that's great, and I hope that they get a lot more fun out of the game while they're doing it.
That was my favorite thing about it. I love seeing different ways that people play the same game that I do and different ways they find it interesting. AC Prater, or ACP Raider 6. He even says, please, he's very polite, he or she. They're sick of the infinite city sprawl that occurs every single game, which might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but take liberties when you're posting in threads. When in history did a civilization from another continent settle right on another civilization's borders when they had the entire continent to settle? Never. Well, I don't know whether that's exactly true, but this is not a history broadcast, so we'll just let that lie. But this person wants to put cultural takeover back in, like it was in Civ 4. And I kind of like that. One of the most fun games that I ever played was actually based on a Realms Beyond scenario that I got from Sula. It was Epic number 11, where we had to do all of the win types were off except for cultural, but we couldn't ever put the cultural slider above 20%. And all of the AI civs were set to aggressive, so I was very scared because I'm not much of a warmonger. But I won. And some of the things I did was take over some cities from the Romans. One of the cities I took over based on another city I had taken over from them before. And I remember sitting there watching and wondering whether the city was going to flip. And it was down to the wire, and while I was watching it and, like, updating my husband on whether it was going to flip and stuff. And it was just really silly and fun wondering whether this city was going to flip when I wasn't at war. I was just, you know, trying to turn it based on culture. And you can't do that in 5, you know. And it's just, I kind of missed it. And so some other people in this thread miss it, and some don't. And I thought it was interesting. This one person said it should be an option. Who said that? Sexing Jay. And then Istri555 said, of course, Civ 4 solved this problem, the problem about you don't like it or you do like it, and somebody didn't like how you fought against it with having to have all of your borders, all of your troops in a city to flip, to not flip it and stuff. He said, of course, Civ 4 solved this problem by having the no cultural flipping after conquest option. The main thing Civ 5 fails at is having no options for anything, which I kind of thought that was a little snark, but maybe they have a point. But anyway. So.
Yeah, I always enjoyed the whole culture flipping thing. It was just a lot of fun to play around with. I don't think there are a few things as much fun as watching your borders sort of slowly creep towards another civ, and you're sort of like the Zerg creep that's taking over, and eventually you start flipping cities. I actually did a game actually did a game once in Civ 4 with the always peace option turned on, so you can't declare war on anyone, and then won by domination just by flipping enough cities to have enough landmass to win by domination, which is really fun. You should give it a try if you've never considered doing that.
Even reading about that game was fun.
Yes, that game was a lot of fun, but it would be a nice option to have in Civ 5. Unfortunately, I don't think it's something that can be done in Civ 5 due to the way that the cultural system is programmed in Civ 5. In Civ 3 and Civ 4, the way that the cultural system works is that individual tiles accumulate culture on them over time, and if you go into some of the debug options, you can see that each little tile actually stores culture from each civ on it, and then based on whoever has the most actually ends up controlling that tile. In Civ 5, this doesn't happen. It's just one civ controls the tile, and there's no accumulation of culture. It's just someone owns it, and then someone else, and then if the city gets conquered, someone else owns it. So there's not, you can't really put a flipping mechanism in the game because of the way that culture isn't stored on tiles. So I'm not sure that it's something that could be done. Maybe a really creative modder could come up with something, but you'd sort of have to rework how the entire culture system is programmed to put it in Civ 5. So I don't think it's something that we're going to be seeing in the base game without a complete rewrite of the cultural system, which is, let's face it, not likely to happen at this point in time.
Well, the only thing that comes to mind for me would be in like a culture war of sorts between two cities. So you instead of picking up new tiles, you set the city to try to overtake in the opponent's tile, and if they do it back, then basically your culture output goes up against theirs for culture expansion, and maybe the differential will claim a tile over time.
But the problem is the whole system's just not programmed that way. There is no culture war whatsoever. It's just somebody owns a tile or somebody else owns a tile, and whoever owns the tile first is just the owner of that tile, period.
There's no
the system's just
ever.
Not there. It doesn't exist. So, yeah. I mean, you could put it in, but I just don't see them writing entirely new systems for Civ 5 at this point, unless they do an expansion, but I don't think an expansion's coming.
By the way, there was a Conquest Always Peace game where you had to win with culture on general discussions of Sith fanatics, and that was very interesting. I'm not sure, was the domination one you were referencing earlier, was that Beyond the Sword or before Beyond the Sword?
Yeah, we did a couple of succession games where you had to win by conquest. And it wasn't always peace, but you couldn't attack cities. You could never attack a city. You could just kill all the defenders and then wait for it to flip. And there was a game where a team actually did win by conquest without ever actually capturing a city.
Yeah. To kill everybody with culture. It took forever. But it was a low difficulty level, so it was doable. I think it was like low difficulty level on Epic Games.
Like,
game speeds are definitely a big impact on that type of game, just because when you have a slower game speed, you get more flip chances. It doesn't scale with speed at all. So, you know, Marathon's obviously the best for flipping cities,
right.
And Quick is pretty bad. But it was kind of fun to just kill people without ever fighting a war. And you would think that the unit chances would, like the units would block revolt chance, but if you have enough espionage and you put them into revolt for long enough on a low difficulty, they will go into strike. So you can clear it all out. Very interesting variant, for sure. The espionage dominates that with the spread culture mission. It is so much better than trying to go raw culture. It's ridiculous.
Episode 125.
Pavo1313 says that you would like civ-wide culture to limit overexpansion. So culture would be global. It'd be a new primary mechanism to limit overexpansion, I guess, in place of happiness somewhat. And it'd be divided by all cities, and each individual city value would be modified by buildings such as a library that increase culture by 1%. Global culture could then be increased for a little for every social policy, wonder, or religion you have. Because the land available to cities in recent Civ games has depended on the culture in the city, this would give players a choice between having a small number of cities with a lot of land or a large number of cities with little land.
This one I don't like as much. I think a lot of people really just can't get away from the jarring impact of global happiness, and that it really isn't happiness, but rather maintenance. in Civ 5. I really think that that's what's leading to this thread here. There already is culture scaling, and Firaxis has just toned it down in the recent patch from settling additional cities. You get your social policies more slowly. Making it have a maintenance component would be taking a feature of the game and increasing its importance beyond what it already is, which is just fairly high, to be honest. And I think you could really get away with just switching off happiness and calling it something else and changing the buildings, what they're called. And at the end of the day, you probably have less people complaining over the happiness model. But I don't think the solution is to make one other aspect of the game even higher impact and then like leave happiness doing nothing.
I think he's more saying, like, he's just referring to the cultural expansion of cities, like how they grab more tiles over time with culture. And he just wants to change that to a global modifier divided by cities, so larger empires get less border pops, which is sort of an interesting idea.
Yeah, that I don't have as much of a problem with. I don't see how it would make a huge difference in normal play, but I don't have as much of a problem with that, I guess. I guess I misread this.
Well, it seems like the main result would just be that smaller empires would grab more tiles quicker.
Yeah, pretty much. But you get the most high-priority tiles ASAP regardless, like either with your culture border pops or you're going, if you really want a tile, you're going to wind up buying it. Yeah. And the others only matter insofar as they have tactical considerations with neighbors, if you have war going on or something. But for the most part, I don't know, I don't see how it would make a big difference. And if somebody's just going conquesting, then you're stealing borders away from other people anyway, and they're going to remain the same.
It seems like it'd be a nice benefit for small empires just because they could get those okay third-rank tiles in a reasonable amount of time, whereas with a wide empire, you're just going to be settling those tiles anyway.
Like that.
Your cities are going to be four or five apart instead of...
Yeah, it doesn't bother me as an idea. I just don't think it's going to make a huge impact on the game one way or another, but I don't have a problem with it, I guess.
In the chat, Civ Battle says, needs to let that thread sink a bit. And if we're going to personify it, perhaps we'll throw in an oxygen tank here, where he suggests, should be more like you can't pop a city without the land being under your culture, maybe. Wow, that would really make cultures amazing.
Jeez.
Capital A, wow.
That would be an
interesting. I would never be able to expand.
I guess
rush archers, those archers. They're cheaper.
The deity AI would like only start with this one settler and never be able to settle its second settler.
Yeah. That would be hilarious. I don't know how you would get the AI to do decently with the bonus scaling. That would necessarily, no matter what, limit expansion rates. And I guess you could give difficulty bonuses to AI culture expansion, but you would have to make it ludicrous to make the game challenging. It would completely break that as a model. Or the game would just be easy on all levels.
Comment today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Because every time I get on Skype, Dad's like, do you want to play games? I would. Unfortunately.
Yeah, he's like, I would, Dan, but it's you asking, unfortunately, and you know what,
No, that's not what I'm
doing. I gotta
cut my hair. I gotta wash my door. I gotta feed my pet Rock. It's really busy.
I actually have
so much to do.
Come on. Not an excuse, reasons, but.
Yeah.
Right?
Record data stored in 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.